The topic for this evening is the life of Israel Zoli. Most of you have never heard of him before today. Good. Yamach Shemo. His name should be forgotten, but I'm going to remember him tonight. Okay. Israel Zoller, Zoller, Israel Zoller, was born in Brody in 1881. Where is Brody?
Austria.
So it's in the part of Poland, or today the Ukraine actually, that was at that time in the Galician province of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Recorder is on, yes. So he's born in Austria-Hungary in Brody, to a family, a very traditional family. The mother's side of the family had many prominent rabbonim in earlier generations. Father was a middle-class industrialist who had a factory in Lodz. Where is Lodz?
Poland.
Which side of the border?
German side.
Yeah. Russian side of the border.
Lodz?
Lodz, yeah. In 1881?
The Germans take that side with Lodz, the Russians get the other.
1881, not 1941.
That's before.
Okay. We're not talking about, we're talking 1881.
Alright,
so the Russians at one point forbid Mr. Zoli, Mr. Zoller from accessing his factory. They prevent him from crossing the border. The family goes impoverished. And what happens when the family goes poor and you can't make it in business? Where do you send the boy? To become a rabbi. That's what happens. Okay. So Zoli's early life is basically irrelevant. He goes to the University of Vienna in his early 20s for a semester, and then is brought from Vienna to Florence to study at the University of Florence and the Italian Rabbinical College, which had just relocated from Rome to Florence in the early decades, in the first decade of the 20th century. Who was the rector of that rabbinical seminary? A man by the name of Rabbi Shmuel Hirsch Margolis. Also a Galician rabbi. What's a Galician rabbi doing running the Italian rabbinical school? Answer is, Italian Jewry, by the late 19th, early 20th century, is the most assimilated Jewry in continental Europe. If you were to look on the street in 1905 in Rome and ask who's a Jew and who's a Catholic on the basis of external features or clothing or language, you couldn't tell the difference unless somebody told you they were Catholic or a Jew. Italian Jewry had done a very, very good job of blending in, but at the same time, their religious profile took a steep decline, and their religious knowledge was almost non-existent. So were there Italian-born rabbis, native Italian rabbis? Not many, or not many of any high caliber. Therefore, they had to import them from the outside. But there's a big... Huh? No, no, you need rabbis. Communities need to have rabbis. But... No. I didn't say they don't care. I say they're not especially observant or knowledgeable in Judaism. But that doesn't mean they don't want to have communal institutions. They do. And they need to have clergy. The problem that the Italians have is that unlike, let's say, German or English or French, which are languages that are useful in scholarship and in the wider world of business and are applicable in more than one spot on earth, Italian is only relevant in Italy. Therefore, who's learning Italian? Nobody. Therefore, if a rabbi wants to have a career there, he has to learn a fairly difficult language that has no use beyond the borders of the country. So, therefore, there aren't any rabbis who are applying for jobs in Italy. It's a tough time for them. So, the Galician rabbis take it upon themselves to shoulder the burden of providing spiritual leadership for Italian Jewry. So Margolis runs the academy in Florence, and Zoller is a student of his.
Just an aside, the Italian community tells us today in Rome that there's very little intermarriage, maybe 5%. Is that true?
Intermarriage?
Today.
Today could be true. I don't know. Could be true. Could be true. So, in 1911... Zoller is appointed the assistant rabbi in Trieste. Where is Trieste?
Northern Italy, near...
Okay, so in 1911, Trieste is still in Austria-Hungary. By the end of World War I, Trieste will be part of Italy. The border will shift. So it's an Italian-Jewish community with a small German contingent. And Zoli fits in as the assistant rabbi, and a year later they hire a senior rabbi, Hirsch Peretz Chayas, the grandson of the Maritz Chayas, and Hirsch Peretz Chayas will later go on to become the chief rabbi of Vienna. And it's a fairly prominent rabbinic figure and a scholar. It was only about 5 years older than Zoli. Now what happens when there's a very small age gap between the rabbi and the assistant rabbi?
Constantly fighting.
Because there's no generational gap between them to indicate that one is a superior to the other. So they're at each other's throats. Zoli and Chayas didn't get along. Fortunately for Zoli, Chayas would move on to the position in Vienna by 1918. At which point in time, what does the community in Trieste do? What happens when the senior rabbi leaves and you have an assistant rabbi who's mediocre but not great? What do you do? You look around and then you end up hiring the assistant rabbi. All right, so he became the rabbi of Trieste and would stay there for the next 21 years until 1939. So he had a very long career, 28 years in that community. In his personal life, he married Adele Litwack in 1912 and they had a daughter named Dora. Unfortunately, Adele died 3 years later. So he was a widower with a young child. And his second wife was Emma Angelina Mayonika. Does that sound very Jewish?
No.
No, that doesn't sound very Jewish. We'll see later on what her real story was. But second marriage, and at the Ufruf, the question was which Haftorah to use. Because in some Kehilot, you don't say the regular Haftorah on an occasion of an Ufruf, you say a specialty Haftorah. So they asked Zoli, who was the rabbi, which Haftorah should we say? And his answer, the shorter one. Now, I mentioned this story now just to bring up criticisms of Zoli's religiosity that will emerge at the end of his career after we know how it ends. People will remember things that happened earlier on and say these are harbingers of his apostasy, that really he was never a pious man, he was always a charlatan, a phony. Okay. What did his congregants think of him? His congregants didn't like him, because he was very arrogant. And he didn't care to minister to them. His main interest was academics. He got a doctorate from the University of Florence in Semitic literature and became a professor of Bible and philology. And he was a reasonably good scholar. He served over a decade as a professor in the University of Padua. So the career that he liked was the career teaching future scholars, many of whom were students for the ministry, Catholic students for the priesthood. And the career that he didn't particularly like was his main job, which was the rabbi of a kehillah, of the Trieste Jewish community.
Was a Jewish city.
Huh? What was that?
Padua was a Jewish
city. Yeah. So, Judaism was in his blood, but it wasn't in his spirit. He liked being a professor, but he didn't like being a rabbi. He always wanted money. He was a mercenary materialist. He was always asking for a raise in salary, and taking money for life cycle occasions that was contrary to the tradition of the Italian Jewish community. He would take money for funerals when you weren't supposed to. All right. Why did he survive in Trieste so many years if he wasn't especially well liked? And the answer, as I said before, there were very few Italian-speaking rabbis, but there's something else. It's not just that there were very few qualified candidates. There's something more important. In Italian Jewry, there is no heterodox Judaism. There is no Reform Judaism in Italy. If you go, even to this day, to the great synagogue in Rome, to the museum, and I remember on our honeymoon, we went to the Vatican, went to the Great Synagogue, and someone asked on the tour, is this a Orthodox synagogue, a Reform synagogue, or a Conservative synagogue? It's an American tourist who didn't know anything. And the guy behind the counter, behind the glass, who wasn't even wearing a yarmulke, said, Orthodox, this is an Orthodox. Now, that doesn't mean people are traditional believers in Orthodox doctrine, or for that matter, pious observers of the halakha. It just means that the community defines itself as Orthodox for historical reasons.
Well, it had separate seating.
Yeah. Separate seating.
I davened there.
Yeah.
The
davening is an old school davening. Orthodox. Okay. So. If the community is not especially observant, but the Kehillah is officially Orthodox, what kind of a rabbi can serve in that kind of a community? No. You need someone who is officially an Orthodox rabbi, but who will bend like a reed and not be stiff like a cedar. Okay, and Israel Zoli fit that perfectly. Why? Because basically he was a phony. In other words, if he wanted to be supple, to bend to the whim of the community on any given issue, or to his own whim, he was ready to do it. But he was an Orthodox rabbi. So he was a good fit, despite being a tough character to deal with and an unlikable guy. All right. There were people who claimed that Zoli was a fascist. There is actually no evidence for that. Even though many Italian Jews did, in the late 20s, early 30s, become fascists, including the leadership of the Rome Jewish community. Because, after all, it was not such a wise move to be an open and avowed believer in some other political system under Mussolini.
I think this should be prefaced the fact that Italy, fascism, which was native to Italy,
yeah,
Until
1938, there's no anti-Semitic component to Italian fascism. That will change on a dime very quickly. But until that point, there were many Jews who went along with the political program. Zoli was not an open anti-fascist, nor was he a great lover of Mussolini. He was a chameleon who did what was in his best interest, and never wanting to antagonize those who were in power. He was a Zionist in the spirit of Achad Ha'am. He was a cultural Zionist. Not that he was anti-political Zionism. He actually did say favorable things about Herzl, but he was a cultural Zionist. Mussolini briefly flirted with Zionism in the early 30s, in 33, 34, 35, and then after the war in Ethiopia, he turned sharply anti-Zionist. And of course, Zoli, after 1935, didn't say boo about Zionism. Always following whatever was politically prudent. Okay. In 1933, he changed his name from Zoller to Zoli, to Italianize the name, which in and of itself is a meaningless gesture. But the fact that he changed his name is meaningful in light of other changes in his life later on. That he is always reinventing himself to suit the times. His congregants didn't necessarily know this, but he also used different first names. His real name was Israel, but for academic purposes he occasionally used the name Ignatz, or Antonio, or Anton.
Ignatz was not Jewish.
Well, it's not as Jewish as Israel.
It's
an alternative. It's something other than an obviously Jewish name. In 1938, as we mentioned, the racial laws hit Italy. And foreign Jews were stripped of their citizenship. So Zoli, Israel Zoli, who was an Italian citizen 1 minute,
right,
is back to being Israel Zoller, a Polish citizen, the next minute, because he was born in Brody. He's worried about being deported.
They took away Italian
citizenship from foreign-born Jews under the racial laws. It was a very tough system.
That happened in Germany.
Well, that's what led to Kristallnacht. What led to the assassination of Ernst von Rath. The deportation of Polish Jews, and then Herschel Greenspan, who we should speak about. Actually, mark it on your calendar. After Pesach, we're going to spend a session on Herschel Greenspan.
For Yom HaShoah.
That's a good time for it. Okay, so he's worried about being deported. The community spends money on lawyers to make sure that he doesn't get deported, and he's able to retain residency rights in Italy.
Even though he's not popular.
You would think so, but yet they were loyal. They were loyal. In 1939, in December, after the war has started, but Italy is not yet in the war, Italy doesn't get involved in the war until after the surrender of France in June of 1940, Zoli moves from Trieste to Rome. He takes over the chief rabbi job in Rome. Why does this happen? Because the previous rabbi, David Prato, moved to Eretz Yisrael. And the job was open. There weren't too many good candidates. When you don't have good candidates, who you hire? You hire Zoli. he said, and I quote, "It's not an honor for me to be the chief rabbi of this community, but it is an honor for the community to have me as a chief rabbi." Okay. When he left Trieste, there were 500 lira of Maus Chitim that disappeared. And they wanted to know, did he account for it? And he refused. That's just one little parting gesture. Okay. He said about himself, "I know how to love better than I know how to make myself loved." Which is a nice way of saying, "I have no friends and I'm not sure why." His daughter Miriam, from the second marriage, later admitted to the American and British chaplains, the rabbis who came in 1944 after the liberation of Rome, that her father really never should have been gone into the rabbinate. He should have done something else in life. But this was his position.
What prompted
apostasy? After his apostasy. Yeah.
Well, she didn't go with him.
No, she did.
No, she did.
The second, the wife and the rabbi convert together. The daughter, not out of sincere conviction, but out of filial piety only, a year later in 46, converts. And she stayed that way and was died not that long ago, a couple of years ago. Yeah. Okay, so he was not only the chief rabbi of Rome, he was also the head of the Italian Rabbinical College, which at that time had moved from Florence back to Rome. And his students in the college accused him of not being especially observant. He during davening, he would fall asleep. He would read secular literature. He would suck on hard candies, and he would use his talus to wipe his glasses. He he sped up the davening and would leave early after Uval Etzion.
So not everything is bad.
Well, yeah. He also used to mock some of the mitzvot. He made reference to the mezuzah as a pagan amulet, and the shofar is a little trumpet that hurts his eardrums. He also did something, and maybe you could blame this, that he had a heart condition and had not such good control over his bladder, but he used to not bother to go upstairs to the bathroom from his office. He would urinate in the wash basin. So, you know, this is an example of, we're not being Dan Lekaf Schus at all. Every little minor Avera we're going to magnify because of his status as a Meshumad. Okay. He used to also... or just indifferent to religion. We'll see that he wasn't especially much of a believer. He also said Kale Mole on days when you don't say Tachanun. Now, of all the things you could do wrong, that's probably the least offensive thing. But I mention it only because in the records after the fact, they pick up on every little Aveira he ever did. He said Kale Mole on a day when you skip Tachanun. All right. He also used to violate the Mechitza rules, which actually, by Italian standards, is a big sin. Because, as you know, there's a pretty strong Mechitza in that great synagogue there. There's a pretty sharp divide between the men's section and the women's section. But he was a little bit loose about that. Some said he was an atheist. Why did they think this? Because he would downplay the miracles of the Bible. He would take like the Ibn Ezra approach, for that matter, the Chief Rabbi Joseph Hermann Hertz approach of minimizing the supernatural character of biblical miracles.
When was he doing this? 39?
All throughout his career.
No, okay, but 11 years or more makes a difference. With Hitler going on, I assume they knew what was going on.
We'll get to the issue of who knew about Hitler. That's the one area where he's right, and everybody else is wrong. Okay. He claimed that certain of his changes to Italian Jewish practice were not out of religious laxity, but rather out of a desire to purge Italian Judaism of superstitious and pagan influence. For example, there was a custom among Italian Jews to go to the kever of one's parents on a yard site and sacrifice a chicken. Now, the last I checked, that's not in the Torah, it's not in the Talmud, it's not in the Shulchan Aruch, it's a Mishigas. And he abolished it. So he would point to that as an example of not all of his reforms were, or his little quirks were bad, where some were actually virtuous in getting rid of the evils that had crept into the minhagim. Okay. He used to make fun of his rabbinical students and tell them the rabbinate is not a prestigious job. You're going to have like miserable careers, and why are you doing this to yourselves? You're a bunch of pathetic souls.
Not for nice.
No. Although the conservative rabbinate is for good Jewish girls these days, so it is. It's a very good job. It's a very good job. So yeah, and so he used to also make reference to some of his students as cardinal this and cardinal that and bishop this and bishop that, which already is leading us in a very dangerous direction. He's using Christian terminology in a Jewish context, and sometimes the English name of Oso Haish is used by your average American when they stub their toe, right? Okay? People say these things. Well, so did he. But he said it a little bit too much for the chief rabbi of a major European Jewish community. And people heard it and they caught on that there's something going on here.
Did he ever have any disciples who also went along with
him? No, he had no disciples of a Jewish nature. He had students in Padua and then later at the Gregorian University after his shmad. But he never had any loyal disciples in the rabbinate.
Was there ever a movement to get rid of him?
Okay, so they did get rid of him during the war. We'll see. He was fired. He was fired and then he was brought back.
But were these complaints made after?
So all these complaints were made throughout his career, not all piled up at the end. Yeah, the dossier is made at the end, but each individual complaint was known at in its time. But since each individual complaint is made by one person with one specific complaint, that's not enough to throw a guy out of the rabbinate or out of Judaism. The totality of all the complaints, which isn't known until in hindsight, leads us to say he was a bad character. Okay. Now, he was fired. He was fired on April 2nd, 1944. But he wasn't fired for religious laxity or, for that matter, being a snob or being a thief or being just a bad guy. He was fired for dereliction of duty. Dereliction of duty. So what happened?
When was Rome liberated?
Okay, let's find out. When was Rome occupied? That's the first question. So Rome is occupied by the Germans on September 9th, 1943, and remains under German occupation until June 4th, 1944. So we're talking about 9 months of hell for the Rome Jewish community. Zoli made a speech in early September of 43, in which he said, you need to disband the community. Everyone should hide wherever they can and destroy all the records. Because if you don't destroy the records, it will facilitate the roundup of Jews once the Nazis take over and grab all the evidence. The community leadership didn't listen to him. So he was right. This is the one thing he was right about. And then on September 9th, he disappears. Mamish disappears. No one knows where he is. Later, he would claim that he didn't disappear. He wasn't completely out of communication. That he still was maintaining ties to that he was reachable. But the record basically is that he disappeared on September 9th. Where did he go? So at first, he was hiding with Jewish families who were friendly to him. Then he realized that's a bad idea. He has to go even further undercover and hide with Gentiles. He was a marked man. The chief rabbis of various Central and Western European capitals had all been killed. Okay, forget about what happened in Poland and in the East to all the rabbonim and the rebbes and all that. But I'm saying the chief rabbis, the Western chief rabbis, many of them didn't survive the war. They were found very quickly because they were targets. Leo Beck survived, but he went to Theresienstadt and went through torture. So Zoli knows, I'm a marked man, I gotta hide. He doesn't hide in the Vatican, that's a myth. All right, Pius XII...
Disappear with his family?
Yes. He and his wife and his daughters, they're together. Pius XII does not take Israel Zoli into the Sistine Chapel and give him bread and water every day. That's not what happened. He was hiding with friends of his who were Catholic. Maybe on church property, maybe not. We're not exactly sure, but it wasn't on the Vatican grounds. Now, he does claim that he was still involved in Jewish affairs. Which particular episode does he say he got involved? The gold episode. So anyone familiar with the gold episode? Right. When the SS came to Rome, they demanded a bribe of 50 kilograms of gold, or else they would deport many, many Italian Jews. That this was ransom for the lives of unspecified number and particular Jews. So the Jews have to come up with the gold, but 50 kilograms is a lot of gold. They come up with 35 kilograms, and they're short 15. So Zoli claims, and the evidence bears this out, that it's true, that he went to the Vatican and he spoke to the Secretary of the Treasury of the Vatican and asked for a loan of 15 kilograms of gold to be repaid at the end of hostilities, at the end of the war, and that he himself would serve as a hostage if needed during the negotiations. That's a nice gesture on Zoli's part. What does the Vatican respond? So it seems... No, it seems that the Vatican was willing to loan the Jewish community 15 kilograms of gold. In the end, it wasn't needed, because the community was able to come up with a full 50 and pay it to the SS, and that was the end of the bribery scheme. It was not a great moment for Christian charity to think that the Jews would have to pay back 15 kilograms of gold after the war, when the church is supposed to teach about philanthropy and charity and righteousness and gemilas chasadim. It doesn't look very good for them. All right? But did the plan work? Did the 50 kilograms of gold satisfy Nazi desires? And the answer is absolutely not. On October 16th, 1943, there was a roundup of about 1,100 Jews, and they were sent to Auschwitz, of whom we don't think more than two or three survived. Now, this is recalled annually in the city of Rome, not just by the Jewish community, but by the mayor and by the city council. It's a big deal every October 16th to recall the deportation to Auschwitz. You don't hear from Zoli for a while. He's hiding. The community continues to function in Italy. All right, no one knows what's going to happen next, whether there will be more deportations. What did the Jewish community think? So before October 16th, before the demands were leveled against them, they were under the impression that under the watchful eye of Pope Pius XII, the Nazis would not be able to commit the kinds of atrocities they could in the dark corners of northeastern Europe. Now, you could understand why an Italian Jew might think that. An Italian Jew who was growing up in the early part of the 20th century in an assimilated environment, acculturated environment, with political freedom, where there's no anti-Semitism, even under fascists until 38, they don't understand the venom of Nazi anti-Semitism. Zoli, who was born in Brody, in an environment which is totally different, Galicia was totally different from Rome or Florence or Milan, he understood that the rishus, the evil that could come out of anti-Semitism, and that murder could follow. So Zoli was right, and the fascist Jews of Rome were wrong in underestimating the ability of the Nazis to kill. Okay. When Zoli eventually emerges from hiding after the liberation, the question is going to come up whether he did the right thing in disappearing, or should he have been a public presence. So the community would argue that it was a terrible blow to morale that their clergyman just ran off and was not there to provide them spiritual comfort. Zoli's response would be, martyrdom would have served no purpose, okay, because live first and then worship God. He quoted an old Roman proverb, live first and then worship God. So he's poo-pooing the martyrdom under any circumstance. And secondly, he said that his public appearance would have given the false impression that all was well. And what do you make of that? It's a rationalization of the highest order. You could use a lot more coarse terminology to refer to that. Okay. There were other deaths, but there was only one significant roundup, yes. Okay. So, there were about 55,000, of whom about 7,000 got killed. Killed people, Jews from northern Italy didn't do well because they were under direct Nazi rule for a lot longer. Okay. Now, people also compared Zoli's behavior with that of other rabbis who were more valiant than courageous. Most importantly, Nathan Cassuto, the son of the great Bible scholar Umberto Cassuto. So Umberto Cassuto had moved to, from Italy to Eretz Yisrael in 1938 to become professor of Bible at Hebrew U, and to work on the codex. And you know, he lived to the 1950s. But his son was a young man in his early 30s, became the rabbi of Florence, and was a very important medical researcher. He was a doctor in addition to being a rabbi. He escaped. And then when he realized his community was in trouble, he went back. And having gone back, he got caught and was killed. So Cassuto was a hero. Zoli was a disgrace, a shanda. All right. What was that? Yes, because he was a very important biblical exegete. We discussed the Satmar Rebbe. We discussed that some escaped, others went down with the ship. But you know, those who lived when many of their parishioners died either had a lot of guilt on their hands later or didn't have a lot of guilt on their hands because they were charlatans. Okay. So when the city is liberated, Zoli comes out of hiding, June 44. You would think if he were a good rabbi, he would care about his parishioners, and he would try to look over lists of who lived and who died, and if of the living, who needs my help? You know, what can I do to serve the community? But no, that's not what he did. What did he do? He asked for a salary for the month that he was out of the office. Yeah, that's hysterical. Okay. So he when Rome was liberated, it was placed under the administration of an American colonel named Poletti, a Gentile, and Poletti had to figure out what to do with the various constituencies in Rome. What to do with the Jews? How do you reorganize Jewish life? Well, fortunately for him, there were two rabbis in the Allied forces who could take care of Jewish affairs. One was an American rabbi, Jacob Hachman. The other was a British rabbi, Meyer Berman. So they were advising the American administration how to deal with the Jews. And at first, they thought that Zoli was a nice guy. He made a favorable first impression. But that first impression turned out to be erroneous, because very quickly they changed their opinion of him. He was constantly bombarding them with requests for money, for food, and for cigarettes. He was a sour and uncongenial schemer in their eyes. In July, the American administration reappointed Zoli as the chief rabbi, despite the fact that the community had fired him in April for dereliction of duty.
And they didn't like him.
So why reappoint him? Lack of better options. Zoli, at this point, tries to get for himself lifetime tenure. Lifetime tenure. He also is trying to get a position in the University of Rome as a professor of Semitics. He tries to support his application for lifetime tenure by getting letters of recommendation from prestigious world rabbinical figures. Most importantly, as I mentioned to you, Chief Rabbi Hertz of England. And Hertz supports Zoli. The irony, of course, is 4 weeks later, the guy's a mishumad, and Hertz is supporting him for lifetime tenure. Okay.
He just
did a favor for a fellow chief rabbi. You know, it's a club, chief rabbi's club.
Didn't know.
Now, Zoli was sick and needed rest. He had spent a year on the run, in which his diet was not very good. He had a heart condition previously. Different places throughout the course of the 9 months, but for the most part under Christian auspices, possibly in church properties. So he's thinking about retirement. He requests retirement. But of course he wants to make sure he's got a good pension, which would be paid for in part by the community of Trieste, in part by the community of Rome for his years of service. So a deal was arranged whereby David Prato would come back from Eretz Yisrael and resume his position as chief rabbi of Rome, and Zoli would retire as a functioning rabbi, but would receive a pension for that, but would continue to receive a salary for being the head of the rabbinical college. But this deal, although Zoli agreed to it in principle in January of 45, he then reneged on it. Why? Because he was jealous of Prato, that Prato was actually a beloved figure, and Zoli was treated with disdain, and he didn't want to be competing with someone who was a beloved figure. Also, as the head of the rabbinical college, that would be a lower level position, subservient to the chief rabbi. So there was no way he could agree to function in a lesser capacity. Also, he had his eye on other academic positions in universities, and he was really sick of dealing with Jews. So on February 6, 1945, he rejected the offer, claiming that he wanted to broaden his horizons. Moreover, the rabbinical college really didn't exist. During the war, it didn't function, and so it would have to be recreated. And it was never an illustrious institution anyway. It certainly was never on par with the Jewish Theological Seminary of Breslau, or the Hochschule in Berlin, or the Hildesheimer in Berlin. Of all the rabbinical colleges of Europe, it was like the least important.
Who are the students there,
Italian? Some Italian and some Austrian German. But by the end, it was mostly Italian.
How old is he
now? Zoli at this point is 64. Okay. So, he says no deal. But he's still on the verge of retiring. On February 11th, 1945... Zoli presided as the Av Beis Din at a divorce of two Yugoslav Jews, for which he took a handsome fee of 1,000 lira. 2 days later, he was a goy. Converts to Catholicism. Now, people didn't like the fact that he apostatized. It's the first important rabbi to apostatize in 500 years. Okay, but they were especially piqued by the fact that he solemnized the divorce. What is the Catholic Church's attitude towards divorce? It's against divorce. So the shyster took $1,000 in his pocket for doing a divorce, and he's against divorce because he's a Catholic. Okay, so all the life cycle occasions officiated at by Zoli had to then be redone on the grounds that when they were solemnized, it was by someone who was not kosher la edus and kosher la leos and dying. Okay, is it not
because? But he must
have
been planning this for.
Oh, okay. So we have to figure out when did he think about converting? Why did he convert? And could it have been predicted? Okay. So
even more important question is, what did the Catholics think?
Oh, we'll get to that. Yeah. So, what does the community do? Well, the community gets together on Friday night after his apostasy. 2,000 Jews come to the Great Synagogue of Rome on a Friday night, including many people who would only come Yom Kippur, to reaffirm their Judaism. Think about it. Their leader switched teams. And you might think that there would be a ripple effect and some followers would go with him to the Catholic Church, a la Jacob Frank. But it didn't happen. He had no one follow in his wake. Why? Because he was a detested figure. All right? But still, if you were an Italian Jew living in Rome, and your chief rabbi becomes a mishumid, so you go to shul to reaffirm your faith in Judaism. Okay. At that service, the assistant rabbi who was elevated to the chief spot temporarily gave a speech, and Rabbi Hachman and Rabbi Berman, the chaplains, gave speeches. No one mentioned Zoli by name. Why not? It would have been indelicate to do so, but also, Yemach Shemo. We don't mention his name. Some people in the Kehila sat Shiva, which in theory you're supposed to do for the loss of the Rav of the town. You sit Shiva, he's dead because he's a Meshumad. Others said, he wasn't our rabbi. He was some shyster. He was, a goon. He was never my rabbi. So therefore, I don't have to feel as though anything bad happened.
Got 2,000 Jews going to shul Friday night.
Without a kiddush, yeah. Okay. So, The American Reform rabbi Louis Newman, the rabbi of Rodef Shalom over on the west side, he wrote a book about the Zoli conversion in 1945.
Wow.
Now, he was a Reform rabbi. Rule of thumb, when you want to write a book about an important historical event, make sure that it's history, not current events, because his book was chock full of errors. Why did he write it? Because in the moment it was a hot story, and if he could sell books. Okay, so there was a certain financial motivation in Newman's...
Did he even speak Italian?
Okay. No, did not. The irony, of course, is that Israel Zoli would not have regarded Louis Newman as a rabbi, because he was a Reform rabbi, and the Italian Jewish community was very hostile to Reform. Okay, so Louis Newman called him the Benedict Arnold of Judaism. I mean, he was very proud of himself that he coined the Benedict Arnold of Judaism, coined that term. Okay, the Catholics were very happy about this conversion, but not all Gentile Italians were happy about it. The socialists said that the ex-Zoller, ex-fascist, is now an ex-rabbi. In other words, he's a phony, he's not a real Catholic. Whatever he does is to just flow, go with the flow. So he changed the name from Zola to Zoli. He went from fascist to non-fascist, and he went from rabbi to Shegetz. In other words, he's always moving. He's always moving.
Did he convert, we'll say, with Lashem Shemayim, or he just said it's a nice thing to do?
Okay, we're going to see. There are two schools of thought on that, and Zoli himself provides evidence in both directions.
Nothing strange with him.
Plays, exactly. Okay. So, the chaplains, Hachman and Berman, interviewed Zoli a few days after the Shmad. They wanted to just get a feel for, you know, what happened? You know, we were close, we were colleagues, what's going on? Not trying to convince him to change, to revert back, or even to be antagonistic, but just to get some information out of the guy.
Zoli
agreed to speak to them. And in that conversation, he threw around the term... Mumr lahachis. Now, what is a mumr lahachis? Spiteful mumr. Someone who does it for revenge. So he wasn't angry with God. After all, he loves God in theory. You know, a deity upstairs. He's converting to a new religion and is supposed to be a pious observer of that new religion. He's angry with the Jews. He's a mumr lahachis against the Jews. Why? Because they treated him so shabbily all these years. Now, did they really? No, he was treated very respectfully, as worthy, you know, for someone who holds the office of the chief rabbi of Trieste and the chief rabbi of Rome. It's just that in his, you know, egomaniacal way, it was never good enough. Whatever the community could do for him was never good enough. They were always going to be ignorant masses, amaratzim, and he was always going to be this great gadol hador. And so, no matter what they would do for him, insufficient. He needed more and more covet, and they didn't give it. Therefore, he'll show them, he'll convert to become a Catholic, just to stick it to them. That's one way of looking at it, and that's, you know, probably the proximate cause of what he did. But there's a spiritual angle to all of it. So, in those early conversations, Zoli and Mrs. Zoli never claimed some sort of a spiritual epiphany. However, in his 1954 autobiography titled Before the Dawn, which never found an Italian publisher, was published in English, actually, Zoli claimed to have had stirrings for Christ since he saw the cross in his neighbor's house, his Gentile neighbor's house in Brody in 1887 when he was 6 years old. This sounds like rubbish. Okay, because in 1887, a six-year-old would not have found anything inspiring about a cross in your neighbor's house. He would have been afraid of it. Or maybe he wouldn't have been afraid, but he would have spit at it when the guy wasn't looking. Then he claimed he had a profound experience, a vision of Jesus, in 1917. Then he claimed he had another one in 1938, and the big one in 1944, after the liberation of Rome, on Yom Kippur, during Ne'ilah, as he was leading the services of Ne'ilah, he felt the spirit of Jesus upon him. And Mrs. Zoli claimed that from the balcony in the great synagogue, she looked out onto the ark and saw a shining vision of the Jesus laying the hands on her husband, Rabbi Zoli. Now, did this actually happen?
Two people at the same time.
Yeah.
Did they have a
lesbian? Okay. So the question is, did he and her have these visions, or did he make it up after the fact to justify what had been a very secular motivation or a very sinister motivation to apostatize? Who am I to say? I don't know. Maybe he really did have visions. Maybe he was nuts. So, as I said, the daughter didn't convert right away, but does convert a year later out of loyalty to her parents. Some said that Mrs. Zoli was not joining the church for the first time.
This was the second wife.
The second wife. That Emma was born not Jewish, and that had been converted, maybe, to marry Rabbi Zoli in 1920. Now, that was a bit Lashon Hara, because, in fact, her maternal grandmother had been born a Gentile and converted to marry her grandfather. So she, in fact, was a Jewess by birth. But since we're dealing with people who committed a treason against Am Yisrael, all sorts of dirt came out, whether true or only slightly true. Okay. So, was there any way of knowing this was going to happen ahead of time? In 1938, Zoli wrote a book. Zoli was a prolific writer, and he was a reasonable scholar. Not a great, great scholar. You know, he's not going to go down in history as being one of the great professors of Old Testament literature or New Testament literature, but he was a prolific academic writer. He wrote a book in 1938 called The Nazarene, in which he examined the proofs in Old Testament literature of the Messiahship of Jesus as reflected in rabbinic literature and intertestamental literature, which is a fancy way of saying what is the evidence of Jesus being the Messiah according to the Jewish tradition. Now, he wrote the book as a university professor, ostensibly engaging in dispassionate research, and not as a partisan theologian. It would be odd for a chief rabbi of an Italian city to be writing as a partisan theologian about a topic that is proofs for Christianity. And yet, if you actually read the book, which I can't because it's in Italian, but just in the few snippets of English translations that are available in the biographies of Zoli, it's clear that the language he uses is not the standard language for a dry professor's college textbook. Rather, it's a flowery and vibrant language that speaks with enthusiasm about the material, as though Zoli were a worshipper, not a researcher of the Nazarene. Okay. So it's a scholarly facade, but in hindsight, it's not much of a facade. So Jews didn't want to think that a chief rabbi converted to Catholicism because he found Catholicism more compelling. They would rather believe that his switch of faiths was due to a personality quirk. But the truth of the matter is that over the years, Zoli was moving over the line into a belief in Christianity and away from traditional beliefs of Judaism. That he didn't act on it right away, that he didn't act on it until he was in his mid-60s after the war, well, we'll have to explain that due to personal circumstance. But yes, clearly from his writings, it seems he's moving along the line of belief in Christianity.
Could he have been influenced by the people that saved him during the war?
Okay, so that's a reasonable argument to suggest that he decided it's finally time to make the move. Not that he came to believe in the truths of Christian dogma because they saved him in the Shoah, but rather he was already believing along those lines and hadn't acted on those beliefs, but now that they saved me, in gratitude maybe I'll finally take the plunge.
There was no kickoff to his congregation or anything. I mean, they may have...
Okay.
Could I just say, I don't believe it's much of a Jew to begin with.
It wasn't much of one, no. Yeah. It wasn't much of a Jew. Okay, so why did he... If in 1938, yeah.
In Christianity, do they have the same protocol that we have in the conversion process where you don't go from 0 to 60 in 2 days?
Okay, so in theory, you're supposed to study the catechism before taking baptism, but in fact they're not so particular about it. In Zoli's case, as a Bible scholar and a man of the cloth for many years, he knew Christianity, you know, pretty well, and so he had done his homework. But you can go to baptism whenever you're ready. It's not like the Geirus with the Rabbanut, where they string you along for months and months and months and make all sorts of demands on you. The church is happy to sprinkle the holy water on you.
They want you.
They want you as quickly as possible.
So
why, if in 1938 his beliefs were already in line with Catholic doctrine, why did he wait 7 more years to convert? So 2 reasons can be suggested. One is that a person who has spent many, many years in one line of work and doesn't really have anything else that they know how to do is reluctant to give up that job. A goy can't be a rabbi. That's what he does for a living. And so if he were to become baptized in 1938, 39, well, his career is finished. He'll have to hope for some kind of a scholarly career in a Catholic setting, which he couldn't guarantee for himself. So, also, there were opportunities for professional advancement. In 38, he was still in Trieste. Rome is a big deal. As much as he would poo-poo it and say, oh, it's not a big covet for me to be the rabbi of Rome, nonsense. It was a big covet for him to get the position in Rome.
Did it help him get professorships? Now, like in the old days, you couldn't get...
Yeah, of course, it did. He was teaching Gregorian University. They were happy to give him a job. Once the chief rabbi of Rome converts, of course they were going to take care of him. They weren't going to leave him unemployed. So one is that he was worried professionally, how can I leave the rabbinate? It's what I do. There's an opportunity to grow in the rabbinate, as much as he hated it, you know, for the glory. The second factor is, and this is very important, in 1938, yes, he published the Nazarene, and yes, he's probably a believer in the other faith, but it's also the year of the racial laws, which means even if he's a Christian, he's still racially a Jew. And who's to say that under the fascist regime of Mussolini, now cooperating with Hitler and anti-Semitic decrees, that it's going to help him even one bit that he had a baptism? He might go to Auschwitz just like the half-Jews of Germany. Okay, so he's worried about these things, and since there may not be any advantage to converting, don't convert. Okay.
Maybe because he was waiting for that 50 kilo deal to go
through. You make it sound like it's a drug deal.
No, so
is the money? Maybe. So there is a claim, and I can't verify this, that he had an option to go to America in 1939 to become a professor at Dropsy in Philadelphia, but that he declined because he didn't want to abandon his flock in a difficult hour. Now, that sounds like him telling a story after the fact to make himself look good. We don't really know if that's true. Okay. I don't know. That'd be interesting to find out, yeah.
What happened to his books that he wrote? Did they burn them?
No, I don't think there was any book burning. Okay, so in Italy they don't burn books. In Italy they preserve books, whether your own religion or somebody else's religion, and sometimes especially somebody else's religion. Okay, Zoli, not the Vatican, made the first overture about baptism. It's not as though he was being solicited for baptism by Pius XII or some cardinal or some bishop. Zoli volunteered it. That's an important point. This is not the 11th century where they're going to Amram and saying, convert, convert, convert. No, he went to them, which makes it a lot worse. Okay, now, Zoli and Pius XII were never especially close. People got the erroneous impression that they were very close because Zoli took on the name Eugenio Maria Zoli after Pius XII, whose real name was Eugenia Maria Pacelli. Okay. So, obviously, there was an affinity, it was an affection, one direction for the other, but not necessarily being reciprocated. Something of an unrequited love. They did have a meeting. No, Pacelli was not a nice guy.
The very estate of the Vatican, his dealing diplomatically was exceptionally cold on all sides.
Very cold. His concordat with the Reich was a disgrace. He was not a friendly man, not a nice man at all. He was basically a Fabissina. So
that's surprising that Zoli liked it.
Yeah, well. So the two of them had a 25-minute meeting a few weeks after his conversion in March of 1945. And after that, for the next few years, Zoli would continue to stress how altruistic the Vatican had been during the war, claiming that at the instruction of Pius XII, many, many Italian Jews were saved. There was the claim that 15,000 Jews were saved at Castel Gandolfo, which is false. It never happened. At most, about 6,000 Jews in Rome and the environs around Rome were saved on church properties. Many, many different church properties, but not 15,000 and not at Gandolfo, and not necessarily because Pius XII said so. That's a very important point. Everybody has their own das, their own mind. Every person in this world can be moral or immoral. And plenty of Italian Catholics in the vicinity of Rome who had ties to the church, were employees of the church, made decisions to save Jews. Not necessarily because they were instructed to do so by a superior, by a higher up, or the highest up, Pius XII. He could, to save his reputation, his admirers say it was all his doing. Well, if you want to say it was all his doing, what about the express train to Argentina and to the South American capitals where the Nazis were sent by the Catholic Church to save them from Allied prosecution? If the Church said, oh, Pius XII knew nothing about it. Well, the buck stops somewhere. If you're going to claim he saved everybody, then you have to admit that he was in charge of everything and he let the Nazis go. Or neither one was his doing, which is more like it. Okay, so people who had an interest in extolling his virtues, like Zoli did, would make up all sorts of extravagant claims about who was saved by Pius XII. All right. In late 40s, Zoli was living and teaching at the Gregorian University. Why was he living there? Answer is because after the baptism, his family was getting death threats in their apartment near the Jewish quarter, near the ghetto. So they had to move out of town, which it could be reasonably expected. Not that I'm condoning the death threats, but you know, you'd figure he was going to have to move out of town. You can't just stick around. Yeah. All right, so he established an organization that facilitated the entry of Mishumadim into Catholic life. In other words, he felt that there were other people like him who were struggling with their identity, with their religious identity, and need help transitioning. So that was his big mitzvah there.
Did he have a lot of business?
Not much, no. In 1950, he agreed to be interviewed by Ma'ariv, by the Israeli newspaper. And the reporter asked him what he felt about his Jewish identity. And his response was, I feel like I was never a Jew. Now, that's a very telling statement. He says, it's like I was born Catholic. That's a very unpleasant thought, but all right. So, he said that Jesus took him by the hand across the threshold. It wasn't that he was pushed there by political reasons or by circumstance, but that he had spiritual help in crossing the threshold. He claimed that he had not abandoned the God of Israel, but rather had fulfilled the covenant, which is classic Catholic doctrine that the Jews, you know, biblical Israel, had a mission in this world, but their time had come and gone, and that true Israel today is the church, and that's fulfilling the biblical promises.
He's a Catholic.
That's what he believes. All right, in 1946, he sued the Jewish community for his pension. But they took him to court. They refused to pay it. And he appealed. But he dropped the appeal when he realized that the legal fees would add up too much and it wasn't worth it. He claimed that he still loved the Jews and he cried for their suffering. And in fact, he was actually a supporter of the State of Israel. He did not become like an anti-Zionist or some sort of an Arab-phile as a result. Well, I don't care really, but it's just it's interesting because sometimes a religious transformation away from Judaism also results in a real hatred for Am Yisrael in the flesh and a desire to see them destroyed by, you know, Gamal Abdel Nasser. Okay.
Did he improve his lifestyle? Did he become richer? Did he become
No. Interestingly, he lived a fairly Spartan existence in the last 9 years of his life on a college campus His diet improved, his health improved, he looked gaunt and like death warmed over in 1945. He looked like a fairly healthy 73-year-old in 1954. He came to America in 1953 and taught at Notre Dame in South Bend. The Jewish community considered protesting his appearance there, but then thought better of it. Let him be. You know, why cause a ruckus?
Why give him publicity?
Exactly. Why give him publicity? He's old news. Old news. He claimed that when he met Pius XII in 1951, Pius asked him, "How's your people doing?" Now, this is Zoli telling a reporter what Pius asked him. Most likely, that remark never was made by Pius towards Zoli. What was Zoli doing? He was strategically, playing it, making it seem as though even the Vatican still thought of him as a Jew, so that no one should think he was a betrayer of the Jews, to make his Avera somehow mitigated. Okay. He's always ever the liar, in my opinion. Okay, the one good thing he did, the one mitzvah he did after he converted, was he had attempted to reform the unpleasant parts of the Good Friday liturgy, which call for the conversion of the perfidious Jews. The perfidious Jews. He asked Pius XII to delete perfidious from the liturgy, and Pius refused. Later, under John 23rd, that word would be eliminated from the liturgy. Now, some wanted to claim that Zoli's conversion was an important first step in the eventual rapprochement between Catholicism and Judaism, which would go on with Second Vatican Council. However, the scholars who have researched this say that that's not at all true. It's not a fair assessment of what happened. Even if Zoli had never been alive, whatever rapprochement would have happened anyway, and that Zoli didn't contribute to it, he was dead by 1956. Now, when he dies, he's buried in a Catholic cemetery. And upon his death... Huh? That's true, but Ed was a good man. Ed never converted out. He went high holidays, went to Parkey's synagogue every year. He used to sit next to him. It was a mensch. And
I was going to say, they're not two of the same color.
No. So upon Zoli's death, he becomes an irrelevant personality in the history of the Jewish people. In Italy, his name was still a dirty word. For the next few decades, as long as there were people still alive who remembered him and had, unpleasant feelings towards him even before his shmad and certainly afterwards. But outside of Italy, yes, it was a big news story in 1945. But by 1946, he's old news and gone and forgotten. Good, because we don't need to have any chief rabbis converting out anymore. Okay, we'll stop here.